To At the Devil's Ball, the podcast where we talk about horror and genre movies in a positive and constructive manner. I'm Samuel Numene with you as always, my co-host Nathaniel Johnson. How are you doing tonight, man?
Doing okay. Doing okay. It's been a long day.
Yep. I want to right out of at front apologize to everybody listening. If my sound quality is not as good as it usually is, we're having some issues on the home front, and I'm recording this off of a tablet currently. So, my apologies if it sounds pity or far away, or if you even have to listen to my voice, you know, which is already bad.
It's going to kill the whole show. This is it.
The whole vibe is done, you know?
Yeah.
But anyways, joining us tonight, we have from Skewered Universe podcast, Leanne and Jeff. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
Thanks for having us. What a pleasure.
Well, thank you for coming. And, going to tell everybody a little bit about yourselves and what you do over at Skewered Universe, or before we get started?
Sure. Well, the Skewered Universe podcast is hosted by Leanne and myself, and we review horror movies. Sometimes we'll step outside of the genre just to give ourselves a little bit of a break. But the way we review the movies when it's just the two of us is we break them down sort of horror host style in what we call interstellar interstitials. So we will watch the movie in 15-minute increments, broken up by vintage drive-in ads, and then we'll come back and kind of give our real-time thoughts as we're watching the movie. And then at the end, wrap it up and let you guys know whether you should watch it, if it's something you could pass on.
Yeah, we'll like let that. You know if it's crap.
Right.
And then we typically have guests on, like we've had Paul from Evasion of the podcast and Strange Highways, and we really need to get you guys on for an episode as well.
Yeah, we'd be down for that. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
We've also had Tony on.
Tony Wash from Scotchworthy Productions. I don't know if you guys are familiar with his work at all.
No.
Yeah, him I'm not familiar with. Yeah. But that's very cool. And then you do another one, Jeff, right?
I also do Tales from the Podcast. Every Saturday we go live at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. And we are currently going through every season of Are You Afraid of the Dark, one episode at a time.
Wow.
We ran a poll on YouTube, and that is what the fans chose, so that is what we are doing. And it's actually been a lot of fun, because I didn't experience the show growing up.
Nor did I.
I was just aged out of it,
right?
So slightly. So going back and seeing it, I know if I was in the right age group, I would have loved it, because I'm having fun with it so far.
Yeah, that's a tall order, though. There's a lot of episodes of Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's something like 50 total? Or 60. Yeah. Well, there were five seasons?
Five original seasons and then two seasons of the revival. And I think there might be a couple of specials that are lumped in with that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So
I was going to say one of my first, I talked about an episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark when we did a kid horror Halloween special a couple years back that gave me I had like a weird existential crisis. As like a 10-year-old watching it, that was mind blowing. And it was such a weird formative experience. But it was the reason why I was so existential was because I was unable to actually articulate why, because I was watching it. It was Tale of the Lonely Ghost.
Okay.
Which I know you guys did recently, because it's only like the second episode, the third episode of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And something about it, like the idea, the thing is, I was watching it. My mother was in the room and I just started crying. I was burst out in tears, just hysterical. And my mother was really upset. She didn't know what was going on. And she's like, you know, taking wild guesses as to why it was so upsetting. And I was unable to articulate. Well, no, it's not so much, because she was like, oh, I know it's different when it's kids or whatever. I'm like, no, it's not about that. It's about the idea of being trapped in a mirror and like being unable to like interact with the world, created this existential like terror in my head and it was so sad that I couldn't, you know, I wasn't unable to like articulate it. It was mind blowing. It was such a strange experience that I'll never forget it. I have yet to watch the episode as an adult because I'm worried it will upset me, which is really stupid and silly, but I just never did.
That is not stupid or silly.
Yeah.
Not
but
at
yeah,
all.
it was such a weird experience. And but yeah, I'll never forget it. It's etched in my memory. And of course in my memory, it's of course way worse, I'm sure.
Right.
Like it's, you know, it's something that was made for 10-year-olds. It can't be that bad, but But yeah, it was such a but maybe that episode was in general pretty sad anyway. Like,
yeah,
it was, yeah, I mean, it was a sad story. I remember it had a happy ending, but like,
it was a pretty heavy story. It did come away with a happy ending, but when you realize like what the ending means as an adult, you're like, oh, it's still kind of like a dark ending, even though there's a happy reunion at the end.
Right. Because the mother like reunites with the kid, but they're in the afterlife. But
yeah.
But they're still in the pocket dimension afterlife. Like, it's like, you know, but yeah,
it's like
the weird metaphysics of all of that. So.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, yeah. I've been having fun going through those. So, and like I said, Nathaniel, I reached out to you because you expressed interest in coming on Tales to do Are You Afraid of the Dark Semi. I'll throw it out there. If you're ever interested, let me know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to work on
a
that.
Lot of episodes.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to, I'm going to find a Saturday where I will be free. And then, I'm all aboard on it. Cause I do,
like I said, take your time. So
yeah,
totally understand working around your work and all that. We'll make sure.
I have yet to watch an episode of, you know, that show. So, it'd be nice to get a, you know, newbie opinion on it, I guess.
I think you'll dig it, Sam. I think it's really, from what I remember of the episodes, they're really cool. I mean,
I haven't seen it either.
Yeah.
Oh.
They were pretty cool. But yeah, it was a cool show. I haven't seen the new ones. And I've seen, I haven't, by far, I haven't seen that many of the original either, but, because I think I can't remember how old I was when that happened, but I remember that for whatever reason, I think I ended up watching like real horror movies shortly thereafter. And then I never looked back. So like I aged out of it like immediately. But I found in my old age going back and watching like kid horror or even sometimes like kids or family movies are end up being a lot of fun. You know, once you get over, I think being in your 20s and being like, I'm not watching this kid shit. And then you get older and then you're like, actually, this is pretty cool. But But yeah, I'm glad you're having a blast with it, Jeff. I think
sounds cool.
Yeah. And we'll definitely take you up on that invite. But we are finishing off this week. We are finishing off Paul Verhoeven month.
Yep.
Like Jeff was talking about with Skewed Universe, normally we are nominally a horror film podcast, but we do move away from the genre. We've done that the last couple of months, really. Mm-hmm. And probably we'll be continuing to do that, I think, in next month as well. Although it's Basic Instinct, the movie we're doing this week, is a little bit more, it's a horror film. I mean, you know, it's one of the, it came out during a period in which the horror genre commercially was a little bit more in decline, and there was a kind of a movement towards what they would end up calling suspense thrillers, which were basically just pretentious people versions of horror films.
I
liken it to the modern day equivalent of people talking about elevated horror.
Right.
It's still a horror.
Yeah, they're horror films. Yeah. They're horror films made for people that don't like horror films, and like Sleeping with the Enemy, or what was the one of that with Michael Keaton? I love that movie too, and it was
Disclosure.
No, Pacific Heights. Disclosure was Michael Douglas.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and Demi Moore. But that was another one. But a lot of them were very like, you know, polished and pretentious, and were a little bit more like, you know, we're too good to really get into the nitty gritty of what makes a quote unquote horror film. And so Basic Instinct is definitely one of those types of movies. I'll do the vitals real quick and then we'll jump into
let's do the vitals.
Yeah. So as noted, we were doing Basic Instinct. It came out in 1992, directed of course by Paul Verhoeven. Writing credits go to Joe Esterhaas, who at the time was actually the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood at the time of this making. We'll talk about him a little bit. And then we've got our main cast of Michael Douglas, Sharon Stone, George D'Azunza, Gene Triplehorn, Dennis Arndt, Leilani Sorrell, Bruce A. Young, Chelsea Ross. We've got Daniel Von Bargen, who we did talk about a while back. Wayne Knight, better known as Newman. And then a Mitch Pileggi pops up in this thing. He is actually just named Internal Affairs Investigator. He doesn't have a name, which I thought was odd because he was already had starred in films prior to this. So it's kind of weird that he's a little bit kind of doing nothing, a nothing part in this. And then we have music by Jerry Goldsmith again. And then makeup effects by Rob Bottin. Again, kind of out of nowhere. And then we have the cinematography by Jean Dubont. That we talked about, who directed The Haunting 1999, one of the worst movies we've covered on the show. but I love that movie, and I talked about that at length when we talked about it. But and so Jeff and Leon, when Sam approached you to come on our show to do for Paul Verhoeven Month, you guys picked Basic Instinct. Am I right about that?
Yeah, neither of us had seen it.
Okay. So is that the reason why you chose it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, I was familiar with RoboCop, familiar with Super Troopers. Right. So I was like, Verhoeven, he's already won me over with those two. So let's Basic Instinct. Right. Yeah, why not?
Starship Troopers, not Super Troopers. Yeah. Super Troopers.
Oh, yeah, Starship Troopers. Sorry.
Very different movie, Super Troopers.
Right. Oh, man.
A very good, fun movie, Super Troopers. But
I have a very different feel if it was directed by Verhoeven, though.
The swinging bits probably would have been a hell of a lot different if Verhoeven had done it. I had never seen the film either, Basic Instinct. Sam, as somebody who'd seen it before, talk to me a little bit about, why don't you start us off? Tell me about Basic Instinct.
Basic Instinct is, kind of a neo-noir thriller, which, is about a woman who, kills somebody in the same way as, she wrote in a book, and, shenanigans ensue. The investigator and the Michael Keaton falls in love with her, and
Michael Douglas.
There's a Michael. Damn it! See now, now you're
the whole episode is just going to be saying the wrong people. Wrong names of everything.
Michael. Yep.
We'll put it out there with a secret decoder thing, you know.
Michael Douglas falls in love with her, and there's a lot of hardcore fucking in this movie. well, maybe not hardcore, because they did get an R rating.
Aggressive?
Aggressive fucking, yes. There you go.
It's certainly that. But I
watched this when it came out on video with my brother. And like 90, I guess it'd probably be like 93. So I would have been like 15 or 16 at the time. Definitely too young to see it in the theater, but we were kind of surprised by how graphic it was. And we enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine watching it at that age with your brother.
Right. I mean, we watched a lot of action movies and, thrillers and stuff like that, and sci-fi movies, but not Basic Instinct. That was the first for us. We did go on to watch a couple of other thrillers like that, I think Bruce Willis's Dead of Night. I think that was
Color of Night.
Color of Night. I remember that.
That was the first comparison I had while watching this earlier today, because we just watched it earlier. This is in the same vein as a lot of those things around that same time.
And of course, we both, we went on to watch, Joe Esterhaz's other, films from them, Sliver and Jade, which were both pretty good. I really enjoyed this movie back then for many reasons.
All of them involving Sharon Stone, I imagine.
Right, of course.
Yeah, I remember my friends coming back seeing it and going, oh my god, you gotta see it, because she shows everything. And I was like,
right. Which is funny because when I was looking up trivia, apparently she was not preferred.
Right.
And almost lost the gig.
Right, right. And, you know, and I was also surprised by how good it was, though, back then, you know.
Yeah, it was really good.
Right. And then I didn't watch it for the next, you know, however many years until now. So it was, and it held up on repeat viewing. So why don't you guys tell us a little bit about your first time watching it, and we'll kind of go around the room.
All right. Well, I wasn't sure what to expect because I knew Verhoeven directed it. And coming away from it, I think it's a really good film. Like, I had a good time watching it. I was trying to figure out exactly what was going to be the reveal, if she was the killer or if we got somebody else or if there was a huge twist. Mm-hmm. But then by the end, I'm like, is Verhoeven doing a send-up of these type of films? Because you look at RoboCop and you look at Starship Troopers. And maybe I'm overthinking it, but I'm like, because the male dialogue in this, I was like, some of this stuff is a little ridiculous and a little over the top, but maybe that's just me with a 2024 brain looking at a 92 film and overanalyzing or thinking too deeply. Maybe
I
it's
think
just
you got a point there. I think Paul Verhoeven, you know, is really interested in subverting, you know, expectations, subverting genres. So I think
yeah.
he might be on to something.
Because this is my own takeaway at the end of this was a lot of the male characters seem very reactionary and kind of not as smart as they should be. And all the women were like five steps ahead of everyone else.
Right.
So I was like,
which is funny because this movie was another one that got Verhoeven slapped with that misogynistic title. Right. Which looking at it now in 2024 and being like, I think they may have misread that because this movie is like all the women are capable and the men are dumb as shit. But
right.
Yeah.
Like every one of them is, with the exception of Gus, who kind of sees everything, except he's still kind of a bumbling cop. And he's like, why are you getting caught up with what she's telling you? You need to keep your head on straight. He's really the only one that's kind of like, probably shouldn't be doing what you're doing. Everyone else is like, well, this is an open and shut case over here. It's like, but it's not. You
right.
Are you not going to look into all the other things that are blatantly laid out in front of you? I don't know. That was my takeaway. I'm not sure exactly how.
Oh, yeah. Gus is doing a lot of legwork over in the periphery of the film. And then he does go on to do a pretty dumb thing. But yes, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, one of the things that I was struck with while watching Basic Instinct was I was like, actually, this is probably some of the most realistic cops I've ever seen. Most cops I've ever met are this dumb and this inept.
Right.
That, you know, and this willfully inept, like, you know, they walk in the very beginning of this film. They walk into a crime scene and they're just laughing about it. They think this is pretty funny. Like it's,
right.
You know, I love the line of, oh, he got off before he got offed. You know, they think, you know, this is, and they're just sort of like poking around in this room. Like they're not really even like trying to protect the integrity of the crime scene. Nothing. That I'm like, yeah, these guys don't care about what they're doing. Right. And you know, and I mean, I've made no secret on the show, I'm not a fan of cops, so right. I'm like, you know, okay, these are it turns out Jeff's a cop and I'm gonna be embarrassed, but you know, but no, I mean, it's
far from it.
Okay, good to know. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I took away. So I think you're onto something, at least with that. In terms of the way the male figures in this film are pretty useless and are easy prey for these much stronger, smarter, diabolical women throughout the narrative. Obviously, we'll get to Beth, who's also... I think in my opinion is there's more going on with her than than I think the film suggests. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, as far as send up, I think you're onto something there too. I would say, to a degree, you're also partially right, I think, in the sense that this was a movie made in 1992. I had joked online, I was calling it Significant Glances, the movie, because it's a lot of people staring at each other intensely while delivering dialogue that is very on the nose, despite the fact that they're speaking largely euphemistically. But they're like, you know, it's right. All insinuation, but it's not insinuation. They're just saying it directly without saying it directly. It's really weird. But right, it's but it's really interesting to look at as a like the scene, the one of the earlier scenes between the characters of Nick and Sharon Stone's character, Catherine, where right. She calls him Shooter and he's finding out that she knows about him and his past. And then at the same time, they're like, you know, basically eye fucking each other while she's like outright eviscerating him and he's like into it. It's really, it's like this whole movie is just such weird interactions. But yeah, I mean, so, is it a send up? I mean, maybe to Verhoeven it is. I don't think it is to Douglas and Stone. I think they're playing, I think the cast is playing this completely straight.
Yeah. Yeah. Because even certain things that I've heard him say, like Starship Troopers, we all know is blatantly obvious what he's doing.
Right.
But even RoboCop has those subtle little things like the I'll buy that for a dollar guy, those little digs at like consumerism and things.
Right.
They're thrown in as his little jabs at everybody. Within RoboCop, which is just this ultimate, beautiful, gory masterpiece of a cop film, my opinion. Right. So I think this is just a different take for him to go, well, I can still do things, but in my own way. Maybe. Yeah. Like I said, he could come out and be like, you're an idiot, Jeff. You don't know what you're talking about. Not that he'd respond to me, but you never know.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's worth noting to your point as well, Jeff, though, that I alluded to it earlier. Joe Esterhaus, when he wrote this script, he wrote the script in 13 days, deliberately trying to write what he called the lowest common denominator film. He was basically writing garbage, right. And sold it for a lot of money. And it
actually
got him...
that's exactly how I feel about it. You guys are so intellectual about the thought being put into it, and I'm just over here thinking it really kind of seems like just a basic, really good whodunit cop crime movie, and it just happened to have a lot of sex in it.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said about that. You know, it being like a detective, not a detective story, in the same way that, like, you know, airport novels, detective stories are. Where it's,
yes, know, it's, I was talking to Jeff earlier about it. I thought this reads as a thriller novel written in the 90s. Like, it's hitting every single note, but it's very entertaining and very good.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what makes those things, you know, those things so consumable, is that they're entertaining and even, you know, well thought out and meticulously executed, I guess would be the thing, you know, because this is like, it's really like a well-oiled machine of how to do this kind of movie better than most people have done it.
It's a little long.
Yeah, it's a little long.
That would be my only real criticism of the film, is that I do feel like it's a highly self-indulgent film, I think. And so occasionally I think maybe, you know, an editor could have chopped a few minutes here and there out of this thing. Right. But everybody involved, I think, is just having too much fun to do that. And so they're like, we're going to just keep rolling, keep moving. I think to a degree, Leon is also correct that in some ways, like, this movie is designed to be a crowd pleaser more than in anything else. However, as Jeff did note, Verhoeven is also known for fucking with his audience a little bit. And then you do have a screenwriter who was, you know, not particularly committed to writing anything good as much as he was just writing something that was marketable and trashy. I mean, he wanted, you know, and in many ways, I look at this film as it's basically trashy Vertigo. I was going to call it, I was going to say it's horny Vertigo, but Vertigo is already pretty horny.
A little smutty.
Yeah. Well, Vertigo, I mean, I think this is the movie Vertigo would have been if Hitchcock had made it 10 years later. You know, when attitudes towards sexuality changed, because, if you watch Vertigo, it's all about sexual obsession. It's all about, a character who is thinking with the wrong head for its entirety. Because of, you know, if you watch Basic Instinct and you're looking at it and you realize that Nick is the dumbest detective in the history of detectives because he is just following the divining rod wherever it's going.
He's
not, you know, the little Douglas is moving him. that he's not thinking at all. And to Jeff's point, he has a partner that actually who's removed, who is saying, here's maybe what you should be thinking about. But at the same time, it's not just Catherine that's twisting his head. It's also Beth. He's got a couple of different people messing with his mind. Because this movie is so masculine in the way it's told, that, you know, an entire cast full of male characters who assume by nature of being male, they are correct. And they are invulnerable. They are incapable of losing. You know, when he goes to see Catherine and she says, I'm done with you, we're not together anymore, he just can't fathom it. He can't understand it. You know, he's like, but I'm the man. You don't get to tell me no. You know, I've been right all along, right? And she's like, well, no, I'm totally the murderer. And you are totally telling me I'm not. You're so easy to play. Although I don't think she's the only one, but we'll get to that. But, and of course there's the other level of this film, which of course is everybody involved is completely amoral and, including our hero, who is the most, repulsive man.
I mean, from the get-go, they let us know, they're like, he's trying to get sober from the drink and drugs. Right. And you're like, oh, we're not supposed to like him at all. Got it. This is a cast of people you're not supposed to like.
Right.
No.
And even Michael Douglas, you know, and what he was doing press for this film, you know, said that he's like, you know, I'm the bad guy in this as well, you know?
He's certainly not the good guy. I mean, there is no good guy in Basic Instinct. There is just, I guess maybe the internal affairs guys, you know.
but even those, they're assholes. I mean,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And once I saw Mitch Pileggi, all I could think of was like, oh, Horace Pinker showed up. Yeah. Is he going to hop in and sell somebody's TV?
Yeah.
Right?
He hadn't done X-Files yet when he did Basic Instinct, but he had done Shocker. And among other major character roles. And so it was a little, like I said, it was a little strange to be like, wait a minute, Mitch Pileggi is here and he's not doing anything. Why? But we do have Daniel Von Bargen, who is, of course, another great character actor who only has a couple scenes, but he's basically doing, you know, Daniel Von Bargen, and you want to take a swing at him. But yeah, like Sam said, they're dicks too. Right. But yeah, everybody in this movie is generally, if not outright immoral, then amoral. But there's plenty of insinuation that Nick killed people, and he claims it was the drugs, but it wasn't. He killed people because he wanted to. You know, he's lucky. He's been able to worm his way into the life of the woman who's supposed to be telling internal affairs that he's better now. But I love, I mean, it's one of my favorite moments in the entire film when he's like, she's lying. And they're like, she passed the lie detector test. And he's like, I know people that have done it. I did it. You know, he doesn't say right. that outright, but he's like, I broke the lie detector test. Basically saying, mm-hmm. I killed these people probably because I wanted to. You know, it's, and he's like, well, no, it was the coke. But, but no, he,
yeah.
Yeah. He, you know, they call him Shooter. He's attracted to Catherine because she's like him. You know, mm-hmm. it's, and she's attracted to him because he's like her, if she's even attracted to him at all. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's such a weird, moralistically depraved film. And Verhoeven, I think his ultimate goof on the audience is saying, you don't you dare pretend you're above this, because right. you're here, you're gonna wallow in this muck mm-hmm. with us, and you're gonna enjoy it. And it's such a sleazy little film, but it's so much fun to watch and revel in that muck.
That opening scene, though, like when you see the sex happening, you're like, oh, okay, we're just getting right to it. And then ice pick to the head,
right?
Yeah, the guy's like eye pops out. Yeah,
you see Botine's work, and I was like, we're gonna see a whole lot more.
Mm.
And then it was really subtle work after that. It's like they got you hooked in with this over the top, you know, not quite as graphic as Murphy's Kill in RoboCop, but still something where you're like, oh, the eyes are popping out. This is Botine's effects. This is.
And plus the amount of blood, I think I wasn't expecting that. And I love blood in movies. So I found the amount of blood appropriate.
Yeah, for sure. And I was just waiting for more. So they had me there that I'm like, until we get Gus, it's like there really wasn't a whole lot else. You're like, just waiting. But it's still fine. I mean, if I wanted a Botine effect showcase, I'll put on the thing. But just that opening sequence scene that I was like, holy shit. All right, let's do this.
Yep. I wasn't expecting it either. Having seen a lot of 90s suspense thrillers, they were never usually that intense, that gory. And so, to open the film with not only first of all, a very graphic sex scene, but then to follow that sex scene up with, an outright slasher movie splatter kill, just to set that tone and then say, actually, no, we're going to be, way more subtle the rest of this movie. I mean, we do get, you know, we get some dead kids, mm-hmm. you know,
which I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Again, this whole film this whole film is just like, you don't have no idea what's going to come next. You know, the cliche, and of course, dumb people say this often, it kept you guessing, you know, right them to the very end. But I actually was all the way up to the end of Basic Instinct, not entirely sure.
That's a huge credit to I think Verhoeven, because the first scene in the movie, you could see that it's Sharon Stone in that bed.
I couldn't tell. I
wasn't
was
sure hair either.
In front of her face.
There's a couple of shots where you can see her, where you can just make out her face, like just a little bit.
I'll have to watch it again.
So like this time watching through it, I'm like, I know it's her, but why am I doubting it? You know, this whole time. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of, you know, messed with my head in the same way that they're, you know, messing with, you know.
See, I didn't clock it was necessarily Stone. I was actually looking at it going, well, that looks, first of all, it looks like a wig. But I think
that's what I thought too.
It is a wig. She wore a wig apparently at the end of the film too. But the body type and the wig and everything, when we saw Beth the first time, I went, oh, it was her wearing a wig. Right.
They did a really good job of finding two actresses who have very similar body types to kind of throw you off.
Yeah.
Because you're like, well, wait a minute. Certain things are lining up, they're almost exact. So who was it that I saw in the beginning?
Yeah. But I did read online.
The actual killer here.
Yeah. But I did read online today that I guess if you're really paying attention to the body, you see the nudity in the opening sequence. If you're really looking when Sharon Stone gets naked later, you go, okay, that's the same body.
Right.
I wasn't looking that. Wasn't memorizing.
It kind of sounds like you were.
Yeah. Yeah. But apparently if you, according to online, it says that, you know, it's clearly her breasts, and I'm like, okay, right. I guess
that makes sense. I love that body type, whatever body type that is. Ooh, that's right. A nice body type.
The eroticism of this film is absolutely, it works. Not I mean, much. It does. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm watching going, yeah, okay, I'm kind of turned on to, all right, and the more evil like Catherine became, the more I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it. I would probably fall for this too. yeah. The more she turns up that femme fatale energy, the more and more enticing she becomes. And it really, it works. It's a phenomenal performance. Right. And I think a career maker. For Stone, I think she had done work prior, obviously, but I think this was the one that kind of shot her in. Leon, you said you read a little bit that she wasn't wanted originally.
Yeah,
can
apparently,
you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I don't have the article up, but the IMDb trivia, it said that she was not one of the first people in line. I think there were like 10 other people considered ahead of her, and even when she got it. Apparently, she wasn't able to replicate her audition.
Right.
And it almost cost her the job. And so the director had to actually spend more time with her because he knew she had what it took. He just had to, you know, help her get through that. And apparently, Mr. Douglas didn't like that he was not getting the same attention. They wound up getting in a him and the director got in a fight in the trailer, I guess, and the director got a really bad bloody nose, and everyone thought he got hit.
Oh no.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, did he like burst a blood vessel in his nose or something? Or?
Yes. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Douglas
he got so stressed out.
right.
Douglas wasn't particularly well known for being a particularly nice guy. I think, he inherited his father's intensity and things got,
that's
you know,
for sure.
Yeah. And so, Michael Douglas was somewhat famous for playing unlikable, sleazy men. Fatal Attraction had come a few years prior to this, which was another film that was highly, the Glenn Close role was highly contested. A lot of women wanted that part. Right. And so it wouldn't shock me if Basic Instinct was similar, that people were looking at this, that this script got passed around and a lot of actresses probably wanted it because it is such a juicy role.
Right. I feel like a lot of them probably passed on it because of the nudity, you know, required for the role.
I could see that. But I will say, nudity aside, because that's not... It's one of the things we see in the film, but Sharon Stone's acting in this is really just solid. I have no complaints. Oh, yeah. Everything was believable. And the only thing I had seen her in before this, of course, a lot of people out was Total Recall. That was the only other thing I had seen her in. So, and that she's fine.
No, but she's hot in that too.
Yeah.
She really is. Yeah.
But I'm saying, like, she's good for what she does in there, but you really see how good she is in Basic Instinct, what she can deliver acting wise.
You know what? It's kind of funny. Right. They have a similar thing where they're using sex and their body to kind of manipulate these men. And she's damn good at it.
Are you trying to tell us that Total Recall and Basic Instinct are linked in the same universe somehow?
Total Instinct.
Michael Douglas is Arnold Schwarzenegger's character.
Right.
Oh, no.
Well, it's funny. There was a spoof made a couple years later that was called Fatal Instinct, which was the combination of
Armand DeSante and Sean Young, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, it might have been Sean Young. Yeah, I think you're right. But yeah, it was a combination of not Total Recall, but it was Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction were the two main goals. Yeah,
that was Sharon on cable Stone. A lot, so I had seen that before I saw Basic Instinct, and I still have not seen Fatal Attraction. So,
it's good.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, it's really good. And Glenn Close is just truly phenomenal spectacular in it. Yeah. And Douglas is good too, but he's very much the I'm trying to look at Sharon Stone's career right now and see where this falls. So Total Recall was 90.
This was her big role. I mean, this,
yeah,
this
she had not done Casino yet, I don't think.
No.
Oh yeah, I forgot Casino was after, but yeah.
Oh yeah, Casino.
Michael Douglas did Falling Down the following year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Douglas was already.
And that's also a sleazebag role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Fatal Attraction was a sleazebag role. Disclosure was a sleazebag role. He had done, there was another major one for Michael Douglas right before this, where it was, again, it was Wall Street, I think he had done prior to this.
Wall Street, yeah. Yeah. So it seems like his career was sleazebag up until maybe playing Hank Pym, where he's not quite as big of a sleazebag, maybe.
Right. And I read just the other day, it's funny because we were planning to do Basic Instinct, and I saw an interview with him that allegedly he tried to get them to kill him off in Ant-Man 2 because he wants out.
I read that same thing, and I was you guys actually could. You don't need him anymore. He's done really, what he can. I mean, no offense to the guy. I've enjoyed him, but it's like you can move on at this point.
Yeah.
Well, I think Riff Tracks, when I watched the Riff Tracks Avengers Endgame, he has that one at the funeral scene at the end of Avengers Endgame. He's wearing sunglasses, and I think Bill Corbett literally says Michael Douglas is asleep under those glasses right now. Like he doesn't give a shit about being in these Marvel movies. It's just, it's money and he'll take it. But
yeah.
I'm sorry,
the check's gonna be how much? Sure, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah, his commitment to acting was around here with Basic Instinct when he was really really committed to these roles. And doing a wonderful job. I mean, it's another great performance. Sure. He and Stone actually have surprising chemistry. My only complaint, I think, with Douglas being cast in this film is I do wish they'd found somebody a little bit more conventionally attractive, but
and a little younger.
Maybe I could buy older because that still works, but I couldn't help but can occasionally get taken out with, wait, him? Why is she, why are all of these women so into this guy? Not that Michael Douglas is an ugly man, but it was a little weird for these beautiful young women to be like, I'm willing to kill for this man. Beth in particular, Beth, like, being really into Nick is a little bit like, if you're going to, my theory with Beth is that she's actually is killing people in this movie. I don't think Catherine's the only killer. I think Beth is killing people too.
That's where I was going. Cause when you get that reveal of, they know each other in college and they slept together once, I was like, there's more to this. And I think it was left open so we can kind of determine, like, they've probably been working together. And it just so happened that Nick, being so out of his mind, twisted up by both of them, happened to stumble into figuring out part of it, maybe through the work of Gus, when they were both working to try and throw them both off again.
Yeah, my prediction, and while watching the film, my prediction had been, either Nick was going to find out they were in on it together and he was the fall guy and they were actually lovers, or he got caught up as a pawn in a fight between the two of them. Instead, it seems like Beth is doing something independently. My theory is that she's the one who kills Daniel Von Bargen. I think she kills him to protect both herself and Nick, because she's obviously going to become implicated in these murders as a result of her past with Catherine. But at the same time, there is that weird little, like, as you've noted, Jeff, like, Gus is doing real detective work in the film and comes back and says that Daniel Von Bargen had 30 grand in a safe deposit box. Why? Who knows? The movie never tells us, where
I found that a little frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted a little bit more of that.
Yeah. 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 I did too. I thought there was,
Just when they start to kind of get the detective thing going with Gus, he's like, I found her roommate. She's in Oakland. We can go there and get info. You know, maybe we can piece together why Nilsen had so much money in a safe deposit box that had never been touched. It's just squashed immediately. And it's like, you're never going to find out.
We're never going to know.
Like,
wait.
Right.
Did Nilsen sell the information to Catherine? But at the same time, when Nick accosts Nilsen in his office, Nilsen doesn't seem to know what's going on.
Right.
It's, you know, Von Bargen plays it with, wait, why are you hitting me? For a man who sold confidential files, he seems a little taken aback by any sort of actual and once you know, as Mike Tyson might put it, you know, once you're getting punched in the face, plans go out the window. You would think that I expected that scene for him to turn around and say, yeah, I gave her that information, fuck you. But instead he's like, he seems confused. He's like, wait, why are you punching me right now? I didn't do
it. Very much like a guy who didn't sell.
Yeah.
And there could have been an easy explanation, like maybe he set aside that money for children or something, or retirement. We don't know.
But we do know he had been investigating Beth.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, like, wait, why? A year prior, he was investigating Beth. We don't know why.
You start to think, well, did Beth set up Nilsen as a fall guy to throw Nick off, to be like, oh yeah, he must have sold your file because he came in and asked me for it, and he's goes and confronts him to take the heat off of her.
Yeah.
There's so many ways you can go with this. It's just
Or she just told Nick an outright lie. You know, that because he's yelling at her and she says, okay, it was Nilsen. And he goes, okay, I'm going to go punch Nilsen in the face. You know, because again, he doesn't have any critical thinking skills whatsoever. You know, he doesn't stop to think, well, wait a minute. Why did you give Nilsen my file? Like, why was that even a thing you could do? You know, and she just kind of says that under duress. And then he goes and punches Nilsen. And he's thrown out. And then Nilsen turns up dead. But Catherine would have no reason to kill Nilsen.
No.
He had nothing to do with her. You know, so it'd have to be Beth in theory, or somebody else. It was unrelated. But I mean, it is really interesting that there is this other mystery in this film that never gets resolved.
There is also one thing in that scene where we find that Nilsen's been shot and they go, oh, it looks like a .38 revolver. And immediately one of the higher ups walks up to Nick and goes, give me your gun.
Sniffs,
and it's obviously a semi-automatic pistol, and he sniffs it. I'm like, but that's not a .38 revolver.
Right.
You were right within earshot. Why are you sniffing that gun? It wouldn't match even if he had fired it.
Yeah.
It's like, you guys are not very bright.
They're not good cops.
Well, I mean, they never looked for fingerprints on the murder weapon.
No, all they kept saying was, you can find this ice pick at Kmart, which I was like, is this like secretly funded by Kmart, or is that another dig at consumerism? What's going on?
Right. And then they show, you know, her, you know, with the ice pick and not wearing any gloves, you know, and then, you know, later they have, you know, a scene where she is wearing gloves with the ice pick when she kills, God, I forgot his name already.
Gus. I was trying to think if we were thinking about the beginning where it was Bob or if it was Gus. So
no, Gus. Yeah, and so it's weird that they never, you know, bothered to do that, or like DNA evidence, which, you know, they would be using at the time, not as good as we could use it now, but they still used it in the early 90s.
Like, the most detective work we get is when they look up the person Catherine goes to see. Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot her name now. The elderly woman. Yes, thank you, Hazel Dopkins. Yep. And they find out her past and that she was in San Quentin for murdering her family.
Mm-hmm.
And then what ultimately leads to Elizabeth being found out under this alias of Lisa Hoberman and all this stuff and her name change. that's the most detective work we get in this film. Right. Everything else is like a comedy of errors with these guys. Like, well, there's so much blood, we don't know if there's going to be fingerprints. Just bag it up and we'll chalk it up to another homicide that we'll never get to solve.
Right.
Like, wait a minute. No, you guys aren't that inept, are you?
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
They absolutely are. Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's back to that. How I find it very funny that it was called a misogynistic film. Apparently the reason for it being called a misogynistic film was that every woman in the movie is crazy and right. murderous. So people were like, oh, well, he's making a statement about women. But I'm watching it going, I think it's the opposite. It almost feels misandrist because the men are so inept.
I mean, if you think about how quickly Michael Douglas's Nick downward spirals again back to drinking and smoking cigarettes and on the verge of doing drugs again, it's
completely
like
completely unhinged.
It's like right. all from just meeting this woman once
and seeing her undress.
It's like she's got you hooked already. So yeah. she's not crazy. She just knows what she can do and she can manipulate you because you're so easily manipulated.
Right.
Yeah, he's a sucker.
She just yeah. We already know he's got his vices. He can easily falter at any point. I mean, he walks in and orders a double blackjack on the rocks, and all his colleagues are like, wait, what are you doing?
Right.
You're not supposed to be drinking? Doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I quit. I haven't had a drink in 3 months. Like, maybe you should keep going.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the bartender doesn't seem that concerned either. And this is like, you know, the movie Cop Bar where everybody knows everybody, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That would definitely be a cop bar, yeah. Right. Yeah. But yeah, and of course, like, he's such a nasty customer. I mean, there is that scene with Beth that where she's saying no, right?
Yeah, that's
and he right. bends her over the couch. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, like, watch the movie and like, oh yeah, this is our hero, ladies and gentlemen. Right. Like, and then she calls one later. He's like, I was making love to you. She's like, well, you're not making love, you know. It was, you know, it. So I mean, I think that the whole film is very much like it's not a flattering portrayal of men and the way we act.
But it also didn't make her look great either because. Yes, she was the one that said, no, stop. And right. when he ignored that, she started kissing his fingers. And I was a little frustrated at that. Right. I would rather have a rape scene than to see her kissing his fingers after telling him no.
So she just kind of succumbed to just kind of like, well, I guess this is what we're doing. And then got mad at him later.
Yeah, it's like the old, you know, Hollywood trope of, you know, like, you know, the woman doesn't want to be kissed until you kiss her, and like, you know, so she's super into it. Like, it's just like, no.
Then yes, yeah. Right. But yeah, it's. So I mean, that's kind of my main point is that I'm like, well, I'm watching this movie, going, well, the men are awful. Mm-hmm. Maybe the women are homicidal, but it certainly seems like these men have it coming. So it's sort of like, you know, I can't really fault Catherine for, like, you know, taking out the people she's been taking out. I mean, I don't know what her parents were like. I mean, they suggest that maybe she offed her parents, and somehow possibly killed a boxer in the ring. Don't know how.
Yeah, I didn't get that part.
But
I think that just happened to be a part of it. Right. But with her parents, when she was talking about that book she wrote, where this kid, he's, you know, he gets away with killing his parents just to see if he could. I'm like, that's why you did it. You wanted to see if you were smart enough to get away with it,
right.
And you did. And now you're like, well, I've got money and I've got power, so who's gonna stop me? I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
And her killing the guy in the beginning, actually, he's not a good guy either, because they even talk about how he's using influence with, like, the mayor to get political things done. And, you know, we can't let anyone know that he was doing drugs in here because he's an upstanding whatever. It's like, so you're going to do a cover-up. Okay, so the cops are all dirty in San Francisco. Got it.
When that, I'm sure that's true. Yeah, I'm sure that's not made up.
We know for Los Angeles it's true, so it's probably for San Francisco too.
LA is
right.
Great track record.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody, I mean, we all know, I mean, we're watching it, we're seeing it on the news as of like right now, that if you are wealthy and powerful, the law doesn't quite apply to you.
No.
You know, to not, you know, to speak euphemistically, because I got too political in the last couple episodes, so I'm not doing it again. But,
you're of course talking about Joe Biden's witch hunt, right?
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, I mean it, but I mean, he's almost certainly not clean either. And that's kind of the point, is that
all
if you
are monsters.
Yeah. If you are wealthy and powerful, you know, if you find yourself, you know, murdered in the middle of a sex act by with an ice pick and a pile of cocaine, you slipped and fell in the shower.
Right.
You know, they're not going to, you know, they don't reveal the truth. But at the same time, they don't seem particularly driven to solve the case either. You know, they so it's all like, you know, again, from the get-go, we're talking about a really morally corrupt landscape in which every single character is and even though the one, and that's what's fun about it too, is that, like, you know, why Beth, I think, is so much fun to watch and think about and analyze. She's the all-star for me in this picture. I'm watching this movie going, this character is so fascinating because she's introduced as being the morally upstanding one. And then the entire second act is them saying, well, maybe she's not. And maybe she's even worse than some of the other people. That Nick calls her out on it, you know, because one of the things that kept making me kind of giggle a little bit in Basic Instinct was, they're like, Catherine is this master manipulator with her bachelor's degree from Berkeley, you know, a magical bachelor's degree that makes her a master manipulator and psychology expert versus the PhD in the room. You know, it's, well, thank you. Well, don't forget, she's a great literary writer. I've got a literature degree. I do this, you know, you know, it's not, for some reason, Catherine has a magical bachelor's degree that makes her just like way above her pay grade. But,
well, she's kind of got that, you know, Hannibal Lecter thing going on, where, like, you know, she's like the impeccable super genius, you know, needs her to be.
A little bit, yeah. Well, I mean, that's a common trope in this type of film anyway, is it's always been something that it's been more called out recently, like sociopathy is a superpower.
Right.
In this era in particular, or mental illness in general is a superpower. You know, up to even recently with the Hannibal show, where, you know, a guy with autism is basically superhuman in his ability to, you know, solve murders. To the point that even Community made jokes about it. I mean, like, Abed, can't you just solve this crime? And he's like, this is stupid. No, I have a personality disorder. You know, so yes, to a degree, that's what we're kind of looking at, as Catherine's, you know, lack of moral concern is ostensibly a superpower. She's able to basically be like, you know, I can manipulate everybody because I don't feel anything. Or does she, you know, you know, she seems to be a little broken up over, Roxy's death.
Roxy, yeah.
However, is she really, or is she just putting on a front for Nick? You know, we don't really know. I mean, does anybody want to speak to that? What's our read on Catherine? Liam, what's your read on Catherine? Is she, is she a sociopath? Is she,
Yeah, I think so. But I guess technically not, because I think she was really upset about her girlfriend, because she wasn't benefiting from the relationship other than with sex. She's had her around so long that I think it was an actual relationship for her.
Yeah. And Roxy was the one who, you know, was like less stable in that relationship. She was
and I wanted
to watch when she was sleeping with other people and just, you know, doing weird shit like that.
When it comes to Beth, I kind of saw her as one of the bad guys from the beginning, because she's supposed to be this psych that's evaluating him, but she's also sleeping with him, which is like the biggest no-no. That's like the biggest no-no in your career.
Really big ethical overstep there, yes.
Yeah, that's what I notice. I think Roxy's my favorite character. I feel like she's the most real one.
Right.
Yeah, talk to me about that.
Well, she doesn't really hide how she's feeling. And you can tell that she feels things. And yeah, she's a little bit of a psycho killer when she gets jealous, but it's because she's feeling jealousy because she loves her so much and she's obsessed with her so much. And I feel like everyone else is kind of fake, except for, you know, Gus.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone else has a mask that they're wearing. And she doesn't wear a mask. She just wants to be with Catherine and make Catherine happy.
Do anything she can to protect that relationship and keep anyone like Nick from interfering.
Yeah.
Right?
Running him down.
I think she was afraid he would fuck shit up, and he did wind up fucking shit up.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
But Nick is Nick was the focus of the only thing I keep coming back to with Roxy was, and if we're to believe that Catherine actually cared about Roxy, which she might, I also kind of looked at it as a sense of Roxy's death was the one thing she didn't predict, right. You know that, but at the same time, Nick is the intended victim at the end of the day. The novel Shooter is supposed to end with Nick's death by or the cop in the novel, the fictional right. Nick is supposed to get killed by an ice pick by the killer. By the way, I love it's a side, but I love when he goes and sees the novel and they show the close up of, and then his partner gets killed. And right. Nick doesn't think
the legs dangling out of the elevator.
Right. Yeah. And he doesn't think anything of that until it's way too late. But
as soon as Gus stepped in the elevator, I went, okay,
he's walking into getting like, killed. Uh-oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, I guess I had said earlier that Gus did something dumb, but I guess Gus is doing exactly what he's supposed to do. It's Nick who's dumb, but,
right.
but yeah, I mean, if you buy the idea that Catherine is able to predict what's going to happen, which is again a superpower sociopaths have in movies.
Right.
It's like the Joker could predict Batman's car will get smaller in the Dark Knight. You know, somehow. You know, it's when you're psychotic or a sociopath, you get that kind of foresight. But I would have to believe that this woman that she's been sleeping with, her death was not in planned.
Right.
That Roxy was going to go off on her own and try to take out Nick on her own. But also was Roxy trying to save Nick, you know, get out of here before you get killed. But again, you'd have to wonder how much Roxy knows.
I think Roxy might have known everything that was going on, and she was kept close because she was in part of that inner circle. And just now I started thinking, Roxy's death was unplanned. She kind of went off the rails and then drove her car off, you know, that bridge or whatever, and died. So by the end, because obviously Catherine had some sort of hold and was able to work Roxy to do whatever she needed Roxy to do. And Roxy was like, lapdog would do it. Was getting something out of it. So by the end, was she going to start doing the same to Nick since she didn't pick up that ice pick and kill him? It got me thinking right now, like, is she going to make Nick her new Roxy?
Mm-hmm. Well, probably, yeah. Yeah. Right. And I guess
dumb enough and manipulated easily enough that he could fall into that.
It's almost like a vampire making familiars, you know? It's the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually might be an apt read. Yeah, right. That this is the equivalent of a vampire having a familiar hanging around. I guess if you watch the sequel, which I forgot there even was a sequel until I read about it today, they outright state that she does eventually kill Nick. That Nick is dead by Basic Instinct 2.
Right.
Was
Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct?
She was in Basic Instinct 2.
Yeah, that was the only thing I remember when that was coming out, is that she was returning for the sequel. I was like, but why is there a sequel?
Right.
And she was paid a great deal of money.
Yeah,
for that. I guess between the two films, she made something like $15 million, something like that.
Mr. Gotta Eat,
Yeah. Well, I think if memory serves, I remember when I read that, I was like, wait, that there was a sequel. I forgot about that. But when I was reading it, going like, well, yeah, that I remember when that was coming out, and I remember there was something. I feel like I remember reading something about Sharon Stone being like, only doing it because there was a great deal of money involved.
Right.
I don't think she was all that into it. It's supposed to be terrible from what I understand. And it was critically panned across the board. And well, essentially the same movie, except it takes place in France. I guess Catherine is involved in a death in France, and a psychiatrist, is trying to psychoanalyze her and ends up basically being Nick. Where she's, I couldn't possibly have killed all those people, except I definitely did. And then the psychiatrist is like, but I love you, so you must, I'll do whatever you want.
Right.
And then gets manipulated into basically taking the fall for all the killings. From what I understand. Spoiler alert for Basic Instinct 2.
Okay.
I mean, I probably wasn't going to watch it anyway. So
no. I even reading about it and being reminded it existed, I felt no particular compunction to go seek it out.
Yeah,
so
it's on my list right after, Showgirls 2, Pennies from Heaven,
Which I didn't know was a thing until I started looking further into writers and stuff for this earlier. And I was like, there's a sequel to Showgirls?
Right? It's just baffling.
I haven't seen Showgirls. I haven't either.
I was kind of planning to watch it last night after I watched Basic Instinct, but I was way too tired.
It also is trash, but it's a different kind of trash.
And it was also written by Joe Esterhaz.
Right, Joe Esterhaz.
So supposedly by Basic Instinct 2, it basically implied she absolutely does eventually kill Nick. But which is also, by the way, the ending shot of this movie with the ice pick under the bed. When I was like, oh, this is Hitchcock. Verhoeven is riffing on Hitchcock. This is Vertigo, because it has that Hitchcockian. I mean, you could almost imagine looking at that ice pick and hearing the death of a marionette, starting, and then, it's the Alfred Hitchcock Presents. But, eventually Nick will, is not gonna last too much longer canonically. But I found myself wondering when I was watching this movie at the end, even with the ice pick under the bed, I was like, well, wait a minute, did she actually kill all these people? But and then read online that the unanimous decision is that she did, and that she absolutely is the killer. Even though
what normal person would have an ice pick under their bed?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, she used she did the scarf thing earlier in the film that I was like, but it's so I did wonder if like it was supposed to be like she was gonna bring it out. I was like, I have an ice pick.
The weird thing is it's a different ice pick. It's a different kind of ice pick.
She got it at a different Kmart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. She went to, Crate and Barrel or whatever.
It was 92. She went to Ames.
That's for the kids.
That's a reference for the kids right there. Ames, yeah. I'm surprised even I remember Ames. But yeah. But no, you're right. It is a different ice pick.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was like, well, it's different, but she's okay. So, so we're left with all the questions of did she, didn't she? Well, she has the ice pick there, but she could have, but she couldn't have.
Okay, so Leanne, let me ask you this then. Why didn't she kill Nick at the end? What's your read on that? Why did she have the ice pick and not use it?
I think maybe she just kind of changed her mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since we find out in the sequel that she did kill him, so we know she does kill him. So, you know, she at least wants to. I think maybe she just wanted to have a little bit more fun with him.
Yeah,
it could be.
Yeah, I think I think that's probably right. I mean, that there is the line earlier when they talk about the first kill, the guy she kills at the beginning, mm-hmm. and like, you know, that she's like, well, I liked fucking him. So it could just be simple as that.
Yeah,
that you know, Nick is good in bed. And so it's like, well, I'll keep him around for a while.
Which we all watch the same movie. We know he's not good in bed, right?
She's good in bed.
She is.
Yeah.
And she lets him know it too. She's like, he was like, it was the fuck of the century. And she's like,
man.
Was it though? Yeah. She
kind of
looks at her like, what was it?
Right.
There's at one point they're in bed, she's on top, and he starts arching his back. But if you think about the logistics, that wouldn't do
anything,
right? You see what I'm saying? Yeah. So I was like, no,
right?
He doesn't know what he's doing.
he's having sex like Tommy Wiseau has sex, you know.
Yeah, I didn't notice much about Nick's lovemaking in the scenes, but I was definitely preoccupied with Sharon Stone, but because Sharon Stone is absolutely, like, you know, portraying sexual dynamo in bed, and you know, but yeah, Nick is like, you know, but I did like that as well, that he's like, fuck of the century, she's like, I was, but you know, you know, I'm good at this, I don't know about you. But also, I mean, I think there is something to the idea that, you know, also she's queer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's something that it's something that's maybe something outdated now, mm-hmm. but that, you know, that doesn't seem to give Nick pause at all.
No, and I will say, for this being a movie that was released in 92, the times they referenced her having a girlfriend and her relationship with Roxy being this, you know, bisexual kind of thing,
right,
it was mentioned and just they moved on from it. It wasn't like, oh, there was no preaching about anything being wrong or it being weird. It was just, oh, she likes to have fun. She likes men and women. Okay. And then move on. They were like, oh, well, she had a girlfriend. Later on, we hear when he goes and questions the guy washing the car, which I don't know if anybody knows. Why was that cop car so damn dirty? Were they out? Just running it through mud.
The bandit,
I'm like, what Dukes of Hazzard kind of shit were you doing?
Right.
And you're ineffectively washing it with just water and a rag. Like,
right.
Huh? I don't know. It stood out a little bit. It was as egregious as, let me see your gun and sniffing it, when they know it was a 38 revolver. He's washing a car, like, no, water and a rag. I guess it'll take me hours, but I'm still getting paid.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. In the police station, he was smoking a cigarette with the no smoking sign.
Right.
Yeah, they don't care. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, they don't care.
I'm a cop. What are you going to do? Arrest me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, no. When he lets Gus drive drunk.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Leia pointed out.
Well, to be fair, cops protect cops.
That's what Leia pointed out. I was like, well, yeah, that makes sense.
That's what I mean.
If he kills someone on the way home, it's just they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Gus didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
Right.
You know, they, that's what I mean. It's like that. That's why I say it was like, these are the most realistic cops ever, where Gus is just in, completely wasted and just yelling like, who gives a shit if you killed Taurus? Fuck Taurus. I don't want to kill a tourist. Like, you know, and everybody's just like, you know, clearing their throats. And he's like, I don't care, I'm a cop.
But he's just yelling like, why did you fuck her? And that, and they all just, it gets like, quiet. Dude, they all just look at him like, what is going on?
Yeah, and then yes, he does get, you know, get in the car and drive away, clearly intoxicated, You know, with that same thing, as if he gets pulled over, it's just gonna flash his badge and he's gonna be fine. Or he runs somebody over and they'll just be like, you know, oh, he was pursuing a suspect, you know.
I do want to ask you guys a question though about the infamous interrogation scene.
Right.
We do have to get
the first
it.
Time. Yeah. The first time I had seen this, when Catherine is in there and she's, you know, they picked her up from home, she changed, Nick spies on her getting completely undressed because he's a creep and a degenerate. When she gets there and she does her thing and she's just kind of, you know, doing her thing, manipulating all these guys in the room, you know, the DA and the police, whatever, and she does her infamous uncrossing and recrossing of the legs. It seemed rather tame by today's standards with everything that we could see. In 92, it was like, I remember everyone going, oh my God, you can see everything. She spread her legs open. And I'm like, it wasn't just spreading her legs open. It was.
No, you and I paused it. I saw pixels.
You could see the line of where
I couldn't.
It is. I was closer to the screen than you. Not the mouth. That sounds bad. I wasn't like trying.
You're like on all fours in front of the screen.
Your nose was touching the screen.
She's you catch already the slightest glimpse,
right?
And then that's it. Just like
that's it. Yeah.
But it's all about how the scene is shot. I mean, it's tension. It's, you know, it's,
and she knows exactly what she's doing by doing what she did in that way. But I remember there were people on one side going, Wayne Knight just profusely sweating.
Wayne Knight can't even.
He has to sit back.
Wayne Knight is not even controlling himself at all in that scene. Yeah, right. He's just like
everybody leaning forward when she's uncrossing her legs, and they're like, oh, I guess we're gonna get back to work, huh?
I think he licks his lips. You know, it gets so really weird. Yeah,
right.
And
She just has a smile on her face the whole time. Like, I know I've got all of you just wrapped around my finger by doing this.
Yeah.
Because you seeing that makes you all lose your minds.
Right.
Yeah, she's femme fataling all over the place. But
I still remember there were people protesting this movie, like, it is pornographic.
Yeah.
And like,
it is.
Like, kind of, but that scene is naked and
performing sex
act. But I mean, that interrogation is what they were talking about. They were talking about that scene. Like, she
exposed herself. Well, yeah, if they're showing her genitals, that's... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's been countless other movies where that has been seen like that. So this may... In the early 90s, this might have been one of the few. But after that, we see more of that. You can... You know, even in the 70s, there was full-on stuff like this. But for this, they were like... They made it seem like she just went spread eagle in the interrogation room.
Right.
And it's like 2 seconds.
Like it's the centerfold from Clerks where they're like, you know, oh, you can see your kidneys. You know?
And what I think is funny is that because Jeff and I are sitting across from each other right now, when he says spread eagle, both of his arms go out to the side like the horizon.
Oh, I believe
it would be more effective if I had the webcam on.
Well, I would think the reason for it probably had less to do with what is shown and more in the manner in which it is shown. First of all, this scene is so became so iconic that it was lampooned
everywhere.
A lot. This is one of those moments that. You know, I hadn't seen Basic Instinct until last night, but I knew that scene inside and out already. As if I'd already seen it because it's been so referenced. In fact, I remember Jeff, you're a wrestling fan. You might remember back at WrestleMania 21 back in the day, they had the whole WrestleMania Goes Hollywood bit, and they did a parody of that scene with the wrestlers in a smoky room. With Stacey Keibler, you know, moving around. And I think she just kind of spun her chair around or something. But the entire joke was that the men, just like Wayne Knight in this scene, couldn't handle it. They were all, you know, getting all hot and bothered, sweaty.
I remember, and I was a fan of Stacey Keibler at the time. So I was like, ooh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean,
now I'm like, maybe not the best thing to do, but I get it.
Yeah. But okay. the way the scene is portrayed is unabashedly sexual. Mm-hmm. You know, to the point that she is, and I think that's probably what upset people was honestly for the same reason why it was called misogynistic. I think that in 92, one of the differences between then and now, it's not much better now, but it's a little better now in the sense that I think probably a lot of people were just really uncomfortable with a powerful, sexy female who was owning that sexuality or weaponizing that sexuality. Right. That ultimately they couldn't pinpoint why it made them uncomfortable. So I think they were just like, well, she shows Bush. Right. You also do have to consider that, as you mentioned, like, you know, we'd seen full frontal nudity in films in the 70s and stuff like that, but never on a stage as large as Basic Instinct.
Right.
This was a mainstream studio picture.
None of these people complaining had seen New York Ripper.
No. Right. So right. You know, they hadn't been watching Jesus Franco. You know, they hadn't, you know, seen I Spit on Your Grave. Or if they had, they wrote that off as pornographic. You know, and that is a pornographic film. And I think Leanne is right. This is a pornographic film. Basic Instinct is a pretty pornographic film. And I think that's what part of what Verhoeven's goof is, right, is that he's going to confront you with all of this because that's just the kind of guy he is. But I mean, I bet that I would be willing to wager in the original script, the uncrossing of the legs was probably meant to be more suggestive. And then Verhoeven made the choice of being like, oh no, we're going there. Just like we did with the ice pick killing, you know, if you had been going to see Sleeping with the Enemy, you know, that didn't have a full on splatter kill at the beginning of the film either, you know, so you have a film that is confrontational by nature. Mm-hmm. And so you have this interrogation scene, which is also unabashedly, confrontational and aggressive. And so, that would be my assumption, is that what really upset people was they hadn't seen anything like it on the big stage, and were just not ready to deal with what would have been considered a modern femme fatale, who was just like, I am going to not only understand my own sexuality, but use it. And the fact that men's sexuality is so actually so fragile that they're not able to deal with it. You know, I mean, yes, we can joke about Wayne Knight because he's overdoing it. Let's be honest. Right. But
that's what he was hired to do, though.
You know, but you've got five men in suits in a room, you know, who apparently have never seen a pussy before because I remember laughing to myself and yelling at the screen, be like, gentlemen, you are grown adults and you are cops. Like, you actually have a job to do. You're interrogating a material witness, a prime suspect in a murder.
They all come off like it's day one for them.
Yeah.
You can practically hear their brains going hubba, 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 hubba.
Yeah. Wayne Knight looks like he's about to take his shoe off and start hitting himself in the head, you know. you know, but then they all do. And it's one of those things that's like, well, suddenly they're all eighth graders when you know, they're acting like Sam and his brother, you know, watching Basic Instinct at home, being like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this.
Right.
But it's that would be my answer to your question, would be that I think that what we had in 92 was an audience that just wasn't ready for that level of blatant sexuality.
And I think, too, there was also, if you remember, there was the whole movement of, well, what about the children? There was Tipper Gore pushing for parental advisory on CDs. And then video games were too violent. And then these movies were too sexual. It's like, well, just don't let your kids see these movies until they're of the appropriate age.
Yeah, I don't know what kid would want to see Basic Instinct, but
there was so much stuff where it was like, we need to protect the children. We need to step in. It's like, well, let the parents do their job. And if the parents don't know how to parent, then their kid's going to see the stuff. It's ultimately up to them. It's like,
let's not.
I mean, I was watching action movies and stuff as a young kid. I turned out well. Fuck, I'm not going to give myself as an example, but you know,
a lot of people who you know who are this type to pick at this kind of movie haven't won't see it either, anyways. You know,
it's
the irony of it. You know, a lot of people picketing this movie didn't see it. When it was being made, you know, the LGBT people were picketing, you know, and protesting this movie being made because they had just assumed that it was going to be a bad portrayal of bisexual characters.
Right. And in a way it was,
when it came out, you know, the hubbub about that really stopped. And it's not like it's, you know, this movie is a queer icon, but they were a little off base about what
it's not exploitative of that group of people. I feel looking at it with 2024 eyes and seeing how many films out there. I mean, if you watch something from the 80s, like Once Bitten and how homophobic that movie is.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, while I enjoy the humor in it, it's like those parts, I'm uncomfortable because they just keep throwing around a certain F word and these slurs. Right. And I'm like, that's not.
Well, I mean, yeah, you got Ace Ventura coming in a couple of years after Basic Instinct and a lot of the same stuff. But also I would be willing to wager those same people that were picking this movie also probably weren't objecting to Michael Douglas's ass either. Like he's got plenty of nudity in this picture too. But nobody talked about that. It was all Sharon Stone's bush.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really good point.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't go full frontal. I don't think I didn't see any
He didn't. Contractually, he didn't.
Oh, okay. But he definitely showed his butt.
I mean, when they're sitting in that window seat or whatever, he's basically nude. If she would have gotten up, you would have seen everything. Mm-hmm. So there was implied that he's completely nude there.
Yeah. Right. That sex scene is not. Much, yeah.
I mean, it showed as much male nudity as you could get contractually from him as there was female nudity in a movie that's about this exploitation of sex for crime and whatever.
Yeah, all the sex is weaponized in this movie. Yeah. Nobody, I mean, like I said, Nick, there's a whole conversation in which Nick is like, I was making love to you. And she's like, you were not making love. None of this is lovemaking. Mm-hmm. It is carnal fucking and it is all carnal fucking that is being done for power, it's a game that's what I mean is that, like, you know, that sex scene with between the two of them with the scarf is very graphic, but yes, you don't quite see, you know, that Michael Douglas is wearing a cock sock. But, you know, that's all he's wearing. You know, and the only thing really covering it is her naked body. Yeah. But there is no reason for you that your brain isn't filling in that information. I would think that that's part of it, is that, again, it's about the way audiences view the female body and how still even to this day, how uncomfortable that makes some people. And
I mean, people go off the rails if a woman is breastfeeding in public, and it's like, it's kind of a natural thing. It's like, maybe don't be a creep and stare at the woman who's just trying to feed her kid. And it's like, what is it about a woman's breast that make people like freak, especially dudes? It's like, can you just keep it in check for 5 seconds? Like, you don't need to be like, titties, and then turn into a rampant sex criminal or something. It's like,
yeah, you don't need to revert to your basic instinct, you know?
Nice. Yeah, there you go. That might be the first title drop we've ever had in this on the show, actually.
He said the thing.
Yeah, but But yeah, I mean, I think that is part of what's being talked about in Basic Instinct to a degree. Right. I mean, like, and that's what that interrogation scene really is that she does realize all I got to do is flash him and they're helpless. They can't do a thing. They're going to forget their entire job. You know, even the way she holds the cigarette is meant to evoke, you know, a phallic object in her mouth. You know,
and even then she turns the interrogation from focusing on her to focusing on Nick. Nick. Like, Nick, do you want a cigarette? Nick, do you need this? And they're like, wait, how does she know you? He's like, I don't know her.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. She just happens to know my name. And they're like, you sure about that, buddy? And he's like, yeah.
Yeah, we've never met before until just now. But yeah, it's but also he seems to know her, you know, but because he's also used to using sex as a weapon, you know, either as a manipulation tactic or as we see with Beth, you know, clearly he's not not afraid to take what he wants from her. You know, in the bedroom, you know, he, and I'm sure he never really brought Beth much pleasure either, in that sexual relationship. But obviously, but honestly, I think that's the whole, whole film in a nutshell is that, you know, we culturally still at that time, and we still aren't, comfortable as a culture with the female body. And it still is this object of, you know, again, I don't want to get off on that tangent, but I mean, we are having this conversation outside of cinema, even now in 2024 about, you know, bodily autonomy of females and how, you know, the way we culturally want to, if we can't suppress, we control. And, you know, it's, so, I mean, there is that. So, I mean, I think that's probably where a lot of that was coming from was just simply was that. But yeah, I mean, I think that what's also interesting about watching Basic Instinct in 2024 is I don't know if anybody here, I think I might be the only one that's on Twitter for the most part, but every once in a while.
Yeah, I left a while ago.
Yeah, I know, so did Sam. But the idea of every once in a while, there it comes up again where there is this discourse on sex scenes in movies and whether or not they're useful or we should get rid of them or why, you know, should we not have them? And it becomes this really heated argument. And up until now, I usually used Eyes Wide Shut as an example of, well, no, sex scenes can drive a plot. They can actually mean something. Right. Sex scenes can become, and Basic Instinct is going to be my new go-to where I'm like, this is a movie in which all of the sexuality of the film are character moments.
Right.
It is metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, that's, it's, you might as well, you, what you are doing is taking, instead of a chessboard, it's a bed, and it's a game. It's a battle of wits happening. Right. It's because you have, match, you know? You have two people that are comfortable with their bodies who are going, well, I can use this. And we can play a game. And one of us is going to get up on the other. And of course,
quite literally.
quite literally in this case, she's on top. Nick thinks he's the important one in that equation.
Right.
But not because he's unable to deal with the idea that, a woman would be using him, you know, that his natural state is to use, she's using him. But he can't figure that out. But yeah, I mean, it's sex in movies is, and normally everybody talks about, and Sam, I don't know if you did the research this week. Did Roger Ebert hate this movie? I assume Roger Ebert hated this movie.
Oh, they both hated this movie.
Of course they hated that movie.
Roger Ebert, especially hated the ending. He said that, the last shot, like, was, what the fuck did he say? It was, irrelevant. He was really upset that the last shot existed. Like, he thought that, like, if you had it in or took it out, it wouldn't make a damn bit of difference to the plot. I'm like, that does not Scan, did you watch the same movie I did, sir?
Yeah. That's like what I found out. We covered the Elephant Man not too long ago, and that he didn't like it, and he didn't see the message in the film. I'm like, did you watch the goddamn movie? Because the message is blatantly clear.
Yeah,
but yeah, Ebert.
I like to see what Roger Ebert and James Siskel have to say about the movie, because they're usually way off base with it.
Yeah, and, I so said some very unkind things about Roger Ebert when we covered the Elephant Man.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So if anyone wants to hear that, you can go check out.
Yeah. Podcast. That's the is you usually the people that want to add some weight to their argument that sex scenes in movies are bad tend to bring up Ebert, and as if he is the complete final word on cinema. And which, I mean, Roger Ebert was a hell of a critic and was a very smart man and his film his language, craft. He understood cinema. He definitely did. But he also was a prude and very uncharitable to anything that didn't fit his particular worldview. And so, I'm sure that's why, I mean, I was watching basically this to be like Roger Ebert hated this movie. I didn't even need to look it up. I was like, I'm sure he did.
That's one reason why I try to avoid critics as much. Because I'm like, if you can't take your hat off of your own personal views and actually be a critic, which means you need to look at something straight down the middle and assess what it is. I don't want to hear your opinion. I'll take my friend's opinions over someone who's paid by a newspaper or a website or whatever, just because they can generate clicks and views. Because they might not have the same view as somebody else because they want to be skewed to one side or the other, as opposed to a down the middle. Hey, you know what? I really enjoyed this. Even though it doesn't align with my worldview, I had fun. Or, hey, you know what? This was just garbage. Essentially, they play one side or the other. And it's like, I don't have time for
respect,
all that.
I don't respect anybody who, doesn't try to meet the film halfway. And let the film tell you what it wants to be before you make a judgment on it. And that's, Ebert and Siskel did that a lot, where they would just judge the movie going in.
Well, yeah, he would just in particular would he'd be exactly the type of guy we're talking about, where he's like, oh, there's a pussy in it, it's bad. There's nudity in this picture. He obviously famously, if you've watched Never Sleep Again, the Elm Street Legacy documentary,
several
they
times.
Talk about they talk about how he particularly hated Nightmare on Elm Street 3 because as Jeff put it, would somebody please think of the children? So I'm sure he watched Basic Instinct and said, what about the kids? I'm like, yeah, kids are lining up for Michael Douglas movies, I'm sure.
That was the draw.
He was definitely the target audience.
I remember in 92, I was like, what's Michael Douglas doing next?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I can't wait to see.
Yeah, he was also in Teen Beat.
Yeah. I can't wait to see The Game. I bet that's gonna be a blast. I can't imagine anybody would have, I mean, yes, maybe to a degree you would have had kids that would have heard about the nudity and maybe would have been curious. But I don't think this movie was going to be aimed at young people. I mean, it's a little strange, but I mean, to the
right,
my point being that, ultimately that, this is an example, I think, of a film that is utilizing sex scenes in a very, very smart, plot-driven way. And, and I think that it becomes character-driven moments that, while they are certainly titillating and they are certainly exciting, there also are most definitely, I like the word confrontational.
I like the word titillating.
Yeah, it's a fun word. One might even say it titillates. But yes, it's. But I mean, the film is so.
Tit. Sorry, I've watched a lot of Beavis and Butthead. I apologize.
Right.
No, totally. It's but no, I mean, I think that that's Basic Instinct's greatest weapon. I think is that it is. It wants to be uncomfortable. It wants you to examine how you view sex. how you view how you view interactions like that. You know, are you? I mean, to a degree. I mean, can you watch Wayne Knight and think, "Have I ever been like that?" And the answer is probably yes. For most of us, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. You know that. You know, yes, we do become animals sometimes when we see nudity, and maybe we ought to re-examine that. You know, it's worth looking into. Don't be a Nick. It's not a good, it's not a good look. but you know, it's, you know, I can't imagine anybody watching this movie. And of course, I mean, it's 2024 and I'm sure some asshole probably, you know, completely misunderstands the movie and thinks Nick is exactly who they should be in life. But, you know, the same people that watch X-Men and think it's woke, you know, it's
they're kind of the same people who watch American Psycho and go, man, I really identify with Patrick Bateman. It's like, dude, that's not what you should be taking away from that film. That's not someone you identify with.
No,
ever. Nobody. And if so, seek therapy immediately.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's Nick's entire thing is like, is therapy is something he has to manipulate his way out of. You know, he isn't taking stock of himself. He's not actually getting better in therapy. He's just looking for the fastest way out, you know, and so it's, you know, he had a apparently a willing victim, but he manipulated his way out of it. But I mean, that's all Verhoeven too. I mean, that's all very much in line with his themes of people and they're being damaged, and you know, and how these social structures do fall apart when you apply a little pressure. And
I guess you could say everyone was just doing their part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Leanne, any other thoughts on Basic Instinct? Anything else you wanted to share?
No, not really, except that, gosh, the women were beautiful.
They were.
Gosh, I could watch that movie over and over again.
I liked the dance sequence scene. Even though it was totally unnecessary, but the way it was shot and the way the dancing was so choreographed, particularly between Catherine and Roxy. I think it was
necessary.
Roxy. Yeah.
Because so you can't just hook up, right? There has to be the passion ahead of time. There has to be that teasing. And if they're alone, then they can just hook up. But they're at this dance club and you can't hump on the dance floor. So they have to dance. And it shows the relationship that Roxy has and the fact that she's always watching her and sees exactly what he's doing and sees exactly what's going on. Yeah. And it's kind of like the rest of the movie has a very different and specific feel to it.
Right.
Whereas that scene is kind of more fun. Mm-hmm. And entertaining, I guess.
And if you go back and watch that scene again, as you see Roxy when she's dancing, she's looking like
she's looking right at her.
There is a look on her face as she's watching Nick. She's not watching Catherine, she's watching Nick. And if you look closely, Nick is not looking at Catherine. He's watching Roxy. He's looking
right
time.
At Roxy. Yeah.
He's made eye contact with her and he's like, yeah, this is what I'm doing. What are you going to do about it? It's almost like she's going, I see what you're doing. And he goes, yeah, but what are you going to do?
Yeah.
He's here with me, not you. You're over there dancing with somebody.
It's like, totally like the same kind of thing as like two guys fighting over a girl, like, and just, you know, not doing it verbally or physically, but just through looks and stuff, you know?
Yeah. And he even has the line later when she confronts him after their encounter after the club.
Right.
He says, he goes, so Rocky, you know, man to man. Calls her by the wrong name and then says man to man, and she's just, you can see she's seething, like, I want to take you out right now. And she says, it walks off, you're like, yep, she's definitely going to come back at some point and try to do something.
But there's that build up, you know what I mean? There's that build up that I really like.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I love that scene. Also, like the choreography between the dancing of Catherine and Rocky and Roxy, where Catherine's not looking at Roxy either, but Roxy is still still in step with everything Catherine's mm-hmm. doing on the dance floor. But also, Nick is specifically, they're both dressed up really nicely, and Nick's basically just wearing a t-shirt, and he's totally a third wheel.
He stands out like a sore thumb.
Standing out in that whole scene, he does not belong there in any way, shape, or form. And he's so out of place. And it's, I was just watching it going, like, the scene is so indulgent, and it doesn't really need to be here. But man, are they doing a lot with the visuals of this sequence. You know, and telling you what you need to know about these people. And then there's this other guy that's dancing with them too. And, and it's just like this movement of, you know, these very methodical dance movements. And then Nick is just standing there in his like schlubby, you know, street attire. It's such an interesting looking sequence, but the reason why I thought of it when Lan said it was, you know, all the women were hot, that I remember that was one of the sexier scenes in the movie. That the movements of Catherine and Roxy in particular were very enticing and very inviting. Even though in some ways it's a warning, and it's also a trap, you know, it's everything Sharon Stone does in this movie is a weapon, and every movement that she makes, every glance, every line is weaponized. And it's
almost like in nature, how when you see two animals doing certain movements, you can't tell if they're mating or if they're fighting.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, what are these people doing? Are they mating or are they fighting?
And they're doing both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is. It's very animalistic. It's the basic instinct, as Sam put it. That but yeah, if you see two stray cats going at it,
right.
It's both. It's violent. You know, but also like the insect world, you know, like praying mantises. You know, like, you know, she mates and then kills. All of that's deliberate. I mean, Verhoeven knows exactly what he's doing. Yeah. Yeah. Sam, anything else on your list that we need that you wanted to bring up?
No, the only thing that I wanted to point out was that apparently the MPAA wanted this to be an NC-17.
I'm kind of surprised it wasn't, to be honest.
Well, no, like they wanted the film to be an NC-17 because they just rolled that out and they wanted, you know, a movie to take that and run with it and, you know, show that it's not pornography. But you know, contractually, he had to turn it an R-rated film. So
I bet Douglas is a writer probably had something similar. Yeah.
Right. I think it was probably the studio, you know, mandated as R-rated, because even then they're like, they knew that an NC-17 would be like a death knell, you know, for a movie.
Yeah. I don't think there has been a particularly successful NC-17 film that made any money at the box office, you know.
No, home video is another story, but box office,
But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of surprised it wasn't, because it does seem like the type of film that the MPAA would go after.
Was Showgirls released as NC-17? I seem to remember that, but I could be
believe it was. And I think that was one of the first ones. Because I actually do remember it, to Sam's point again, to bring up Ebert. I remember when Seven came out a couple years later after this, Ebert thought that should have been NC-17. Any movie that started pushing particularly boundaries, I remember Roger Ebert being like, why isn't this NC-17? Even though it really, the actual functional difference between rated R and NC-17 is very minor. You know, either way, a R-rated film, anybody pretty much under the age of 18 needs to have a parent involved anyway. Mm-hmm. NC-17 just says you can't bring your kid to it.
Right.
Yeah. But
back in the 90s, you could have your parents drop you off, and your parents would, you know, walk up to the teller with you and say, hey,
yeah,
I'll leave my kid watch this R-rated movie, you know?
Yeah.
Nowadays, you can't do that, but back then, at least.
I think it depends on the theater. But I think there are, I'm sure there are movie theaters out there that don't give a shit. But yes, I mean, I think that's even like the, like a plot point in South Park, the movie, was that they like, go get a homeless guy and have him
buy
tickets. And they don't, the guy at the ticket counter might suspect something, but he's going to let it go because he's just some minimum wage jerk off. You know, it's, the bottom line is, don't entrust your children to your children's sensibilities to people making minimum wage. They don't really care. But
Their job isn't to make sure your children are watching what's appropriate. Their job is to sell a ticket and get butts in the seats.
I think when I was managing the movie theater, I think maybe twice did I ever suggest to a parent maybe they shouldn't take their kid, and both those times I regretted it because the parent got pissed, and I was like, all right, you know what, let your kid watch Evil Dead Rise, I don't give a shit, I'm just trying to help you. They're like,
and that's when you get a Deadpool situation where all these people were like, oh, it's a love story on Valentine's Day, and then they're like, my child saw nudity. It's like, what did you expect? It was rated R.
It's a rated R picture. Yeah, but there were people that were complaining that they took their kids to see a superhero film, and there was, you know, people dropping F-bombs, and there were boobs and violence, and it was like, well, yeah, it was rated R,
like Sausage Party.
That is another example. Rated R. But nobody
but
went.
It's animated. It's for kids. Not every animation is for kids. Come on.
That was the least offensive thing about Sausage Party. That movie's awful. But I would have had different complaints, I think, if I went to see Sausage Party. I would have been like, you know, why did you let me go to that movie?
Yeah.
Why did I go to that movie? And they're like, well, it's rated R. I'm not offended about the content. I'm offended because it sucks. Like, why didn't you warn me? Right. But I didn't even realize that was rated R, but yeah, I guess it was. Yeah. But nobody went and saw Sausage Party, so it doesn't matter. But
I've only seen it like 50 times.
Is it a favorite of yours?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry. Yep.
I get it. We saw it in the theaters. We knew what we were getting into. And I enjoy it on the level of, you know what, this is just one of those movies.
We're very immature.
It's lowest common denominator humor, and I'm like, sometimes I just want that.
I mean, as somebody that has that identifies as having a soft spot for the scary movie pictures, I definitely I get it. You know, I love the scary movies, even though they're terrible. I mean, like,
they just get worse and worse the more you go.
The only one I watched once and never watched again was the fifth one was not even funny. Like, it was
was that the one that had Charlie Sheen? I can't even remember.
No, Charlie Sheen was in three and then the beginning of four. Okay. Five was Ashley Tisdale. Like, nobody even realizes it exists.
I think I saw it. I was like, huh?
One
and two, and that's kind of where I stop.
Three and four have their moments. I mean, mostly because Anna Faris is giving throughout the first four films, one of the best comedic performances I've ever seen. She's so funny in those films. Jeff, anything else you wanted to add about Basic Instinct before we wrap up?
Just that, you know, overall, I really had a lot of fun watching it. And it's not just from the, there was nudity aspect. It's the overall, like, kind of mystery of what's actually going on, the things that are never resolved, and it was just a good watch. While it does kind of follow some of the narrative tropes of the sex crime thrillers around that time, it does enough different in a sense that I would recommend people check it out if they haven't watched it. Because while it is, you know, there's this neo-noir, there's the cop who's, you know, he's a former alcoholic and he did drugs and he's probably still going to do them all. And he's very flawed. And that's kind of typical for those things. There's enough there that I think was written into it and that Verhoeven brought to it that makes it better than a lot of the other things you saw around that time that were in that same genre.
I agree. I was, I remember I went into it expecting trash and to a degree it is, but I was actually taken aback by how good it is. Like it actually is a really good movie.
Yeah. Plus I really like that opening kill with those effects.
Yeah.
As someone who loves practical horror effects and seeing that amount of blood and that amount of just carnage right away. Yeah. I was like, oh, you're speaking to me on a level I understand. Thank you, Verhoeven. Thank you, Bottin.
Right.
Yeah, Rob Bottin does some great work in this film. It's a lot of understated work. And then, you know, Jean Dubon is a hell of a cinematographer and not a great director, but a great cinematographer. Right. But sorry, Jean Dubon. But no, I really was taken aback by how good Basic Instinct is, and I didn't expect it to be. I expected it to be a lot of fun to watch, but I did not expect an actual good movie, and so I was pleasantly surprised. So,
right.
Yeah. Well, Jeff and Leanne, thank you guys for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, this was a blast.
Yeah,
what a treat.
Yeah, this has been a great time. And we'll have to have you guys on again, and we'll definitely hook up again. So, where do we find Skewered Universe?
Well, you can find it on all available podcatchers. So Apple, YouTube Music, Spotify, Amazon.
Podbean.
You can go to Podbean or you can head over to skeweredhead.com. We have links to the show there where you can download it. You can go to, it'll link you to Podbean, link you to our Patreon where you can support the show and get extra episodes. And then you can also check out my other show at talesfromthepodcast.com. Mm-hmm. And you can catch up with us doing Are You Afraid of the Dark over there. And we have something interesting for Skewered Universe coming up that we haven't done. We're actually going to do, instead of a movie, we're going to be doing a whole series.
It's a limited series on Netflix.
Yeah. I don't want to give away the name. I want to keep it kind of a surprise. Right. But we're going to be doing that in our typical, our traditional movie breakdown, interstellar, interstitial style. But the entire limited series.
Yeah, so for every episode, we, you know, take our break, give our thoughts, and then go to the next episode.
Yeah, so it'll probably be like a two-part special, but that's what we're looking to do next. So keep your eyes open for that. And it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Sounds cool, yeah.
Yeah, definitely very cool. And I do like that setup. I think that's really interesting. So I'll definitely have to check that out.
Once we finally hit what we were doing, which was Leanne's idea to do it this way, we actually have felt like we finally kind of hit the ground running with this. And plus, finding old vintage drive-in ads for me is just fun because then I get to relive childhood through listening to those old things about, oh, go to the snack bar and check out this stuff. It's really fun.
It's intermission.
You can tell Leanne has her favorite bumpers that I throw in there.
Yes.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you both so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. And I do the outro, right? Because you do the intro.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I will say, as always, thank you very much for listening. We remind you to love yourself, love your fellow horror fans. Be kind to yourself, be kind to others. Do not be a Nick. And thank you very much. Good night. And namaste. Thank you, devil. Thank you, devil.